Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today we begin with the gamification of theme parks and how Super Mario Brothers at Universal is reshaping how we experience all entertainment. Ryan Skevnicki is a professor of architecture at Marywood College in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He recently wrote a paper about the Super Mario Brothers theme park that opened last year. Welcome to All Sides, Ryan.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's nice to be here.
Before we get into the Super Nintendo world, I'd like you to explain what gamification is. How do we define it?
Gamification is something that is kind of rampant in society and culture today that has little to do with game design and a lot more to do with making something into an addictive process, right? And I think that gamification can be seen in a lot of our apps, in getting points at the grocery store and having your watch tell you that you've closed your rings and all these other small moments that take everyday experiences or things that we do and kind of give us some sort of faux reward for them, and that influence on our lives.
Yeah, you can gamify your chores, your exercise, your weight loss. There are, exactly. are seemingly endless ways to play little games. In some ways, it actually reminds me of the Mary Poppins song where she says that in every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. And you find the fun and then the job's a game. That's sort of the essence of what we're doing here. But in that way, viewing it like that, it sounds like a fun thing, right? If it motivates you to make your bed and brush your teeth and like go work out and eat your vegetables, what's the harm?
Yeah, exactly. It's totally something that we all enjoy and that most people find a lot of success with. I think the part that for me is sort of overwrought is when it begins to either get in the way of other experiences or become so obvious of the aim of a place that it just starts to sour the taste of everything. And I think we're starting to experience that also when, you know, you have to download yet another app to pay for parking, or you have to download an app to pay for your groceries or something like that. And these things, you know, and you get rewards. It's like, I don't need another rewards card or another thing. And I think that that sort of overwroughtness can spoil what is potentially a really nice nostalgic experience.
Speaking of nostalgia, let's talk about Super Nintendo World at Universal Studios Hollywood. You describe it as a trip down memory lane. And you actually enter through a big green steel tube. It's a warp pipe, essentially, if anyone who's ever grown up playing the game. Uh-huh. What's it like inside there? How is it gamified? And how is it also, like, to be honest, I looked at the photos, I read the story. I'm like, as a kid who grew up on Nintendo, this sounds kind of awesome.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, I had the biggest, juiciest, like, smile on my face the whole time. Just like, I couldn't, take it off. And a lot of that was because of the aesthetics, because of how well the architecture kind of seamlessly blended those gamifying technologies in. And let me be clear, Super Nintendo is one of the very original kind of gamification of video games. They early on in gaming, they came up with the idea of coins or high scores, right? And this really got people going on the games, or the Galaga machine at the bar or whatever. But inside this world, it's completely immersive because you're really in a bowl in a, I think I described it as a gully in Los Angeles, and you can't see anything out of it except for the blue sky. And it really immerses you and puts you in the role of Mario. And you get these little wristbands for $40 that I brought into the studio, so to speak, here.
Oh my goodness.
And they don't do anything other, like, they don't tell time. They don't, I can bring this back to the park.
It looks like a kid's
watch,
like a kid's Swatch watch.
Yes, exactly. But it doesn't, you use this to power it up and you kind of slam it on different parts of the park and it makes these coin noises and you just walk around and there's kids just bow, 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 bow. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, I can hear the sound of the coins in my head just from you saying that. But you're right. You pay $40 and you get this, and really all you're doing is going around and getting that dopamine hit essentially from collecting coins, but the coins have no actual value.
Yes.
You can't trade them in like arcade tokens for prizes.
At best, you're buying your entertainment like you would pay for a movie ticket or something that you know is non-returnable, which of course I subscribe it to. But I think that the very real kind of success of Mario and the gamification of life in space comes forward there as a very important part of the architecture or the kind of spatial experience that is otherwise a sort of a nice memory, right? And my thesis as a professor of virtual environments is a lot about how we tend to have a nostalgia about video games as a generation, not just because of the spaces of the game, but because we'd really like to be back down, in our parents' basement without any school or chores or bills or student loans. And I think that's an important quality and something that can be comforting. But at the same time, these spaces also trigger a lot of those other memories, in ADHD generation.
Yeah, I mean, I have Mario Kart, sorry, for the Switch, and I play it with my kids, and they're always amazed that I'm so good at it, and I'm like, oh, I've been playing this long before you were alive. I'm
Absolutely,
like, I've been choosing Wario as my like kart driver since like I was like 17, so
you do see a lot of the parent and child combos there. And it's a lot of it's it makes a lot of sense. I really can't wait to take my daughter who's two right now. So,
you
I mean
know,
those
oh, go ahead.
no, it's okay. I mean those things are all pleasant, and it's it's kind of part of the re-enchantment of the world that I'm interested in. The issue, so to speak, for me is also thinking about how that re-enchantment belongs to a corporation. And it's a little bit. I think it's important to understand.
Yeah, you write that gaming is increasingly becoming an immersive activity. And I mean, obviously, we've talked a lot on Tech Tuesday about, VR headsets and how gaming is changing. I mean, the graphics, even the original Mario who looks vaguely like a plumber versus the Mario of today. So how do you see theme parks and amusement parks emulating this immersive trend?
I think that Nintendo made a very, they made a very important decision when they upgraded graphics on machines to continue to make Mario seem like a cartoon versus a real person. And I think that extent allows the nostalgic experience to extend and the test of time. And I think that's really important. And in theme parks, especially like you see with Harry Potter, you see with new Star Wars and Disney theme parks, it's all about allowing people to become the main character in those stories, become the wizarding student, become the savior of I forget what the Star Wars one is, but there's
Yeah.
some ride where you get you have to rescue somebody, all these kinds of things. And the main character feeling and sort of syndrome is part of our tech, technology allowing us to travel to places that have shared experiences, or we can capture ourselves doing certain experiences. And what I call the imaged experience is the driving force. And so a lot of these to for the question is like a lot of these theme parks basically allow you the imaged experience of being the main character in these different worlds.
You use the phrase main character syndrome, and I want to tease that out for a moment because that is a thing. And you can use that phrase to describe someone who thinks the world revolves around them, like a main character in a book, who arguably the story revolves around them, like you're inhabiting who they are. And I wonder if you see a correlation between these immersive experiences and the what we would describe as people with main character syndrome.
Totally. I mean, I think it's like it's one of those things that's undeniable, and yet, you know, you can have too much of it. But to think that, you know, we don't want to travel to, for example, Rome or Vegas, which I was most recently interested in order to share, you know, when we think about going to places, we think about the images we'd like to see ourselves in and, you know, the perfect sort of pasta photo or the perfect red Vespa in front of the Colosseum. We tend to think of the world through these imaged experiences. And I think it's okay to lean into that. As a society and a culture, I don't think we should be shying away from giving people these moments. I think they can be beautiful and shared, and they are ultimately, you know, new forms of public shared experiences and shared spaces that we're all inhabiting. And I think we should think about them that way instead of thinking about them as these incredibly egotistical things to do. I think it makes sense.
There is a balance to that, though. I mean, you hear a lot about places being, quote, loved to death because of the increased visibility, people dying literally in a lot of like national parks trying to get that perfect shot. Or even you've written about and studied the way cities are changing in order to be more Instagrammable or more social media pretty.
And I think that like Rome and Las Vegas for me were those were two of those places where it's like very easy to observe the power that the images that people want to capture from them takes over the urban environment. And you know, my interest in architecture is all about how we might program those spaces better. Because if you look at a lot of them, sometimes they're just off the cuff, or they are you know, flooded with people who don't have anywhere to sit. And they're sort of resting or lethargically on their phone, just waiting to get to the front of the line to take the picture. Yeah, that's there's something particularly scary about that. But I think if the environments were a little more welcoming and understood, I think we'd have a little bit more of a you know, a public interest in those spaces to say, hey, it's you know, it's your turn. Enjoy that turn.
You know, it reminds me, it circles back to that gamification thing because if anybody who's ever gone to a tourist attraction, a place where people want to take pictures, there are hundreds of thousands of videos on TikTok and other social media teaching you the hacks to get the perfect picture without all the people cr like inside the photograph, what time to go, what day of the week to go, what hour, what season. They're like, if you want this amazing picture in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, but you don't want a million people, here's how you win that photo.
And this is particularly why I joined photographer Iwan Bon in both the book about Rome and Las Vegas, and he happened to be with me at the Super Nintendo World because he's a photographer famous for or famous for many things, but one for capturing people in space so well. And he has a knack for seeing you know, the lethargy that's around, the boredom actually, which I think is a is kind of a beautiful thing in a way, to have those moments in between where you're resting and you're just waiting for the next, you know, bowl of pasta or red Vespa.
You know, I in this conversation about gamification, I also want to talk about the cost of it because how much does a day at Super Nintendo World cost?
I don't know if I can. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, $100 to get in the park. It's $40 for this wristband. It's you know, it's a lot. And it costs a lot of time and patience to get out there and to park. And there's quite a bit going on. And I think I paid a little extra to get into the world early so that I could get the right, you know, vibe of the place, all that kind of thing. And you can spend gobs of money if you really want. And I think that those types of things are important, but there's also things that cost very little, right? Going to see a landmark building, going to public parks, going to the middle of the street or whatever. And I think that these moments are around us, and either they're monetized or not, but that monetization can be obvious and definitely almost distasteful at times, right?
Yeah, I look at somehow TikTok knows that I have small children, and it's like, would you like this video about Disney? And, you know, Walt Disney World and Walt Disney, like they are the epitome of these immersive experiences. But yeah, if you stay at one of their hotels, if you get the character breakfast, if you get like the princess dress up, if you have a little girl, if you want to get one of those passes to ride all the rides and do this, that, and the other, I mean, there are families that spending tens of thousands of dollars on the Disney experience.
Yeah, it's gobs. And it tends to become, and you know, in my main essay about Rome and Las Vegas, it becomes a sort of tool of erasure of the people who aren't supposed to be in the photo, aka, you know, the homeless or the houseless people who are around those cities who are really needing the attention of the infrastructure of the place. And the workers, in my mind too, the workers at Super Nintendo World and other places whose job it is to make you the main character. It's all the more creepy. And, you know, in Las Vegas, you take a wrong turn and you see these humongous hallways that open with RFID tags that have, you know, gobs of people working in the background just to make you feel like, you know, you're the main person for the day. And I think that those moments, when they break, when they shatter, I think that tells us a lot about our society today, and it's places that we can learn from, and it's places, it's spaces that architecture has a lot to do with and to deal with in those moments.
That's Ryan Skivnicki, a professor of architecture at Marywood College in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He recently wrote an article about the Super Mario Brothers theme park in Los Angeles. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks again for having me.
Coming up, how Dayton won the contract to build air taxis, or as I like to call them, flying cars. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. If you've lived long enough to see Back to the Future become the present, then you know those flying cars promised to us in the second movie haven't materialized, at least not yet. California-based Joby Aviation is building electric air taxis that one day will whisk passengers over rush hour traffic, kind of like that DeLorean. The parts are going to be made here in Dayton. It's a full circle moment for the Wright brothers' hometown. And joining us now to talk about it is Ted Angel, Director of Projects and Business Development for Aerospace and Defense for the Dayton Development Coalition. He also serves as the liaison to Joby Aviation, the California-based company. Welcome to All Sides, Ted.
Thank you, Anne. It's great to be on.
When we decided to do this segment on air taxis, I have to say, Back to the Future was the first thing that came to mind, specifically this scene.
Marty! Marty, I wanted to show you these new matchbooks for my auto detailing I had printed up.
Like DeLorean?
Right. And you think a flying DeLorean, and they zoom in and they're all flying and they're like in traffic and it's all like multi-levels. And I think to myself, where the heck is my flying DeLorean anyway? But these air taxis, they're going to be electric and they're going to have vertical takeoff and landing. Are they a flying car? Is that the right way to think about them?
I think a lot of people reference them as flying cars, and I think one day you will see that. I think there are companies out there that are designing vehicles that can be driven on the road and then transform into a flying vehicle. But when we talk about Joby Aviation and some of the electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, We think more in that air taxi, air cargo, emergency management, first responder type vehicle, more like a helicopter of today, just electric and with some different capabilities.
So how did Dayton end up with a contract to build the parts for these taxis?
Yeah, that's a great question, Anna. You know, this goes back to 2006 when the state of Ohio was trying to become one of the FAA UAS centers that was designated through the country. And fortunately or unfortunately, we were not chosen as one of those sites. And I like to tell people that really opened the door for us to think innovatively and look at the market of what was coming down the pipe. And so we have been working towards creating a UAS center in the Springfield-Beckley Airport area, working with our counterparts at the Air Force Research Lab to have some testing a little closer to the area. And in 2019, when the Agility Prime program stood up underneath the Air Force AFWERX program, that really allowed us to focus on advanced air mobility in the eVTOL community and really start to lay the groundwork to attract these companies to our area.
So Joby Aviation is just starting the hiring process. We haven't actually started building the parts yet, correct?
That is correct, right.
When do you think we'll start manufacturing the parts for these air taxis? And more importantly, when will I be able to catch one home from the Columbus Airport?
That's a great question. I was just in Cleveland this past weekend. I would love to have had one myself to get there a lot faster. As of right now, you know, Joby's Aviation's focus has been on their certification of the vehicle with the FAA. And so, you know, it's kind of hard to tell right now exactly when they would be able to do their large scale production of these vehicles. And I'm sure that you know, the Joby reps would be able to answer that a little better, but they are shooting for certification in 2025, the beginning of 2025. And I think if that goes well, then they can start to look at ramping up how they would get to their large scale production.
I will say Joby Aviation has 3 of the 5 certifications they need currently to become operational. So they are working through that process, as you said. You know, and it makes sense that the FAA is involved since it is a flying craft of some kind, but they would be flying much lower than conventional aircraft, right?
Yes, that is correct. So, you know, naturally, as we fly airplanes, we transition from, you know, ground level to about 10,000 feet, and then our aircraft, you know, obviously scale above that commercially right now. You know, we're talking about that 10,000 and below area of operation that most of these aircraft will fly in. And then you add the UAS piece of this, right? So you look at package delivery, drone delivery concepts, right? And so it's kind of a stackable layered system that's going to have to be created with our traffic management system to be able to handle that.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of work to make sure there's no mid-air collisions. Especially once
absolutely.
We start getting a lot more things up in the sky. One of the things I find really fascinating is that Joby says they're working with NASA to make sure that the aircrafts will be as quiet as possible. They're trying to reach a noise level that, quote, would sound like wind through the trees. So, I mean, drones have that whirring, helicopters have that large chopping sound. It's fascinating to me they're trying to eliminate as much of that as possible.
Yeah, it's actually really exciting to be honest with you. I was just at the Farnborough Air Show outside of London, and Joby at their actual exhibit had an example of that very thing, where you could put on a headset and you could listen to what a helicopter, an airliner, and then the Joby aircraft sounded like sitting in a cafe outside or sitting in a park, and it's very telling when you listen to this, to the lack of noise and the importance of that, right? That's a big complaint with helicopters is the noise. And so this is a big focus area that obviously NASA has a lot of touch points with noise reduction in their research capabilities to help with that.
What is it going to mean for the economics of Dayton? Like, how many jobs are coming in? What kind of jobs are these going to be once the Joby manufacturing plant is up and running?
Yeah, sure. So right now we're looking at about 2,000 jobs coming to the Dayton region, which is exciting. Right now I can't speak specifically to all the different job career fields that would actually be a part of that. But as we get closer to them laying out their production plan, I think we'll start to have a better understanding of what those jobs looks like. But they are advertising their Joby, Ohio site, where you can look at those job applications and submit resumes as they start to plan that out.
Unfortunately, it doesn't look like an Ohio city will be one of the first test cities for these air taxis. We may have to wait a little bit. Looks like places like New York, Los Angeles are going to get a first crack at them.
Yeah, I think there's a couple ways to look at that. Some of the focus for the air taxi piece is those 50-mile range movements, right, that you see coming in and out of LA, coming in and out of Chicago, New York. I think that's a big focus area. But I always try to remind folks that we have the regional piece as well, right? The United States as a whole and in the state of Ohio definitely has a large regional airport presence. And that will allow us to open up the window of travel outside of the big cities that we normally have to go through as hubs when we travel.
You know, it's not just electric air taxis that's going to be taking to the skies. We're already seeing what drones can do. So, for example, the Cleveland Clinic has partnered with a company called Zipline to make prescription drop-offs to patient homes starting in 2025. And that is also just wild to me.
Yeah, it's exciting. People are looking at creative ways to help folks who may be at a disadvantage, right? Whether that's where you currently live, or in this case, the Cleveland Clinic being able to take prescriptions to the individual versus trying to find ways to get an individual to the facility to pick up their prescriptions. And you're starting to see a lot more of that as companies like Zipline get certified to be able to do this in other areas.
You've also noted that these smaller aircraft, these drones, could fill gaps in pharmacy deserts, transport organs, blood, medical necessities, that it, you know, which makes a lot of sense to me, particularly as we have doctor shortages that persist in some of our more rural communities here in Ohio.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I think in Ohio, we've been focusing regionally on what those use cases look like for each different community, right? How do we reach out and meet their need if it's taking a doctor to the patient versus us always going out to get the patient and bringing them to the doctor? Or is it something as simple, like you said, as we have a healthcare campus where blood is being transferred from where it's taken from the individual to the actual testing area on the campus. And we can do that in a faster, more fine-tuned way to ensure it's done correctly.
Are you guys working with colleges and universities in the Dayton area to help prep students to work at Joby or to work in some of this new innovative technology?
Yes, absolutely. We have multiple colleges and universities in the area, Sinclair College, Clark State, University of Dayton, Wright State University are just a few off the top of my mind, who are actively involved in looking at multiple facets, not just we always look at the airplane because it's kind of the cool thing, but we're training maintainers and we're training folks that understand electric propulsion and things that are going to be a little bit different. And each one of those universities and colleges are playing a key role in understanding what that means for this new industry coming to the area.
Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is also part of the equation. The U.S. Air Force has its own plans for air taxis. Joby recently delivered its first experimental electric vehicle to Edwards Air Force Base in September of 2023. It's part of a larger program known as Agility Prime. So, will you guys be partnering with Wright-Pat as Joby gets off the ground here?
So yeah, we work very closely with Wright-Patt in the Agility Prime program. It's one of the ways that we were able to stand up our Beyond Visual Line of Sight range that we have at Springfield-Beckley Airport to stand up our National Advanced Air Mobility Center of Excellence, which is at the Springfield Beckley Airport as well. And so we meet with Agility Prime representatives regularly just to ensure that we understand the direction they're trying to go and try to help them in any way that we can.
You know, one of the things that I think when people think about air taxis, if they've heard about it at all, they've heard about it in connection with the Paris Olympics, because there was the whole, we're going to fly air taxis. We're not going to fly air taxis. We're going to demo them. And, you know, the Olympics is probably a perfect place for that because you have so many people packed into the city for this short experience. And air taxis would probably be a great way to move people to and from events, even athletes who sometimes can get caught in the traffic of getting from place to place.
Yeah, absolutely. I know they were pushing very, very hard to be able to fly at the Paris Olympics. And I know that this is a big focus area for the upcoming Olympics that'll be in LA here in 2028. You know, the goal would be to absolutely help them do that. I think about the men's basketball team, right, that's riding a train back and forth from the Olympic area. You know, that would be a great way to move folks and teams a lot faster. And so I think you'll see a lot more traction here in the coming years as these aircraft get certified and are able to fulfill that possibility.
Los Angeles is already notorious for its traffic. So I can only imagine with an Olympics how much they would want air taxis flying across the city and moving people in faster ways.
Yes, I would agree. I go out there quite often, and it would be really nice to kind of just fly in and get work done and then be able to fly back out very easily versus dealing with the traffic.
Yeah. So timeline for getting this plant up and running. When are you guys going to start making the first hires?
Yeah, so that's probably a better question for Joby Aviation.
That's fair.
We are working very closely with them. They have hired one individual so far here in the Dayton area. And I know they continue to look at hiring multiple board members. So unfortunately, I don't have a timeline for you, but we are very engaged with them on when they're ready to execute. We will be here to assist them with their needs and how to help them get those individuals hired.
And when you start the first test flights here in Ohio, I would just like to volunteer to have one of those first air taxi experiences. That was Ted Angel, Director of Projects and Business Development for Aerospace and Defense for the Dayton Development Coalition. He also serves as liaison to Joby Aviation, that California-based company creating the first air taxis. Thank you so much for your time today, Ted.
Thank you, Anna. It was great meeting with you.
And definitely keep me in mind for that air taxi flight.
I will. If you're available August 20th and 21st, we have our industry forum, so that's a great time to come down.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you. Coming up, Google loses big in federal court but vows to appeal. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver. After a 10-week trial, Google lost big in court on Monday. A federal judge ruled that its search engine is a monopoly. The company vows to appeal. So here to tell us what happens next is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So Google lost.
Google lost in just about the most catastrophic way it could have lost. There wasn't like a split decision where certain aspects of the search business were considered monopolistic, or that it was maybe just the mobile part that was monopolistic, which was, you know, kind of widely speculated maybe the way that that goes. No, it was a total, you know, in every possible way, the search business for Google is viewed as a monopoly in which there is no way for a competitor to gain any substantive ground in the current state of the market.
It's a big decision. They're calling it a huge victory for the U.S. government, which has been trying to rein in big tech for years, really. What happens next? What is the practical reality of this decision?
So on its face, very little is going to happen. I'm going to go ahead and say for the next year and a half, because the appeals process is going to be pretty lengthy, and there's going to be a lot of other groups that are going to come in an attempt to support those appeals on behalf of the U.S. government. Curiously missing from one of these trial groups was the company DuckDuckGo, which is one of the bigger, you know, kind of small competitors that that folks who look for alternatives to Google tend to land on because of its, you know, increased privacy, you know, and you know, certain other features that it boasts. Is actually built by some future, you know, former Google search folks. So I suspect that you know, some of these other companies are going to be a part of that conversation moving forward and you know, kind of future cases. In the meantime, it's likely that Google will make some small changes to the way that search functions in order to appeal to the groups that would lay down decisions on how Google needs to break things up in an attempt to say, hey, look, we've already made these changes. Maybe you could meet us halfway and maybe the sentencing won't be as bad. But I think as far as the act of searching for something on Google, that process is likely going to remain the same for quite a while.
What about when it comes to our mobile phones? Because this was a big part of the debate over the auto install, particularly on Android devices, and whether it's a monopoly to do it in this way.
Google search on mobile phones is more than 96% of phones use Google search. And that's because a lot of folks either don't know that there's another option, or that is the default option that gets included, and other options are just not as seamless. It's important to understand that, you know, the way that search functions on most of our phones, where you go to search for something and you hit a button and maybe you already have that app for that thing installed on your phone and it just automatically opens the app, that kind of only works in Google. Like that's a thing that Google has programmed in such a way that it really only functions that way with Google's search functionality. So things like that, we might see change. Google might release in the next version of Android, for example, some developer hooks to make it easier for alternative search tools to have some of that same functionality. Again, in an effort to, you know, kind of limit how much damage can be done in breaking up some of these companies. But ultimately, I think the act of, you know, kind of search as we know it on phones is probably going to remain pretty close to the same for the next little while.
Moving on, let's talk about home ownership and energy efficiency. So we've talked about this a lot on the show, but within the past decade, energy efficient devices have become much more complicated, commonplace. That was a Freudian slip in American homes. But a recent survey shows that more than 50% of Americans think these modifications are too expensive or not worthwhile. So what is pushing homeowners away from some of these products?
Yeah, so it ends up being kind of a split down the middle as to why. The two biggest reasons in the survey that CNET's money team performed over the summer was that half of the groups who are not interested in solar see it as unattainable by cost. It's just very expensive. And the others just don't think that, you know, that having solar panels on your house makes that big a difference. And some of that can be, you know, kind of attributed to just kind of regional based lack of education. You know, there, you know, a lot of these solar companies have not done a great job explaining exactly how those cost savings work. And instead have just been like, it's less expensive, but it's hard to say that something is less expensive when the installation is like $10,000, you know, to cover your roof and solar panels, because that certainly does not sound less expensive to folks who are, you know, kind of trying to get their monthly energy costs down.
Yeah, I also think there's a real education around solar panels, sometimes even the most basic thing, which is, yes, they still work when it's cloudy out. I can't believe the number of people who are like, oh, they don't work when it's cloudy. And I'm like, sir, can you see outside without a flashlight when it's cloudy? Then the panel works.
Yes, it definitely will not work as well, but it works really well. Still, even small solar panels that you would have for like, a car or something will still work very well in cloudy days. There's also, some deliberate misinformation. I think we had a sitting senator for a little while there who would say on a regular basis that using solar panels would deplete the sun, which is not how any of that works.
That is a wild take.
It really is. And it's a thing that, we thankfully don't hear quite as much anymore because it was, kind of laughed out of public discourse. But that kind of misinformation is a big part of why, some folks will kind of turn their nose up at solar because, it's a little more work than just kind of hooking up to the systems that we already have in place. And spending that additional money, seems like a lot until you see just how much of the savings, that, would end up coming in place. It's also really important to keep in mind that not every house is set up for solar. Maybe they're not positioned, quite right, and maybe there's like heavy tree cover in the area. Like it's tough to have that conversation in a national sense when it really needs to be kind of a local conversation.
Further down in the survey, 32% of respondents said they were concerned about the overall cost of these upgrades. And solar is definitely one of those that has a large upfront cost. But I wonder how much of some of these smaller things, like conversion to certain kinds of light bulbs, energy efficient appliances, I wonder how much of this is being pushed by the economy, rising inflation, and just concerns about how much am I really going to save if I upgrade to this $2,000 energy efficient fridge?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, if you start at the very basic, light bulbs, LED bulbs have more than proven themselves as being not only less expensive upfront when you go to buy those light bulbs, but they just last longer without having to swap them out. They definitely don't last forever. And as has been pointed out on several occasions, there are some of these companies that claim that these bulbs will last a decade, and they definitely don't. There's also a fair bit of, kind of education surrounding that stuff. LED bulbs tend to produce a fair bit of heat, and there are certain places in your house where that's just not a great, idea to have, really, really, really bright LED bulbs that put off a ton of heat. So yeah, it's a lot of it ends up coming down to, to pretty simple kind of in-person education.
Yeah, I love that 13% said they didn't understand the best way to make energy efficient homes. And I think that gets down not only to education, like we've been talking about, but to this fear of doing it right. Like you want to maximize, you want to make the right choices on the right products for the right fit to get the most bang for your buck. And that can cause decision paralysis.
I have several friends in my immediate social circle who, on a regular basis, will share the current capacity of their batteries on things like Facebook, because very much like folks who obsess over having the perfect lawn, maximizing that energy output is a thing that just makes them happy. Some folks are just nerds who like charts, and that's as simple as that gets. But any change that you're going to make in that direction is going to be better than not making a change in most cases. And yeah, sometimes that choice paralysis, you can apply that to pretty much anything. Ultimately, you're going to end up making a decision based on some pretty basic research at this point. There's a ton of information out there for what ends up being best for your specific situation.
Yeah, I've even had decision paralysis in the toothpaste aisle. I mean, there's
That's
just so
right.
many options.
Well, and I think the toothpaste people do that on purpose. There are so many choices.
So outside of, going down the rabbit hole of every review CNET has ever written about products, how can we make these smart choices? Because ultimately, how can we get past a lot of these concerns? Like economic concerns are like that's a whole other conversation, but when it comes to this confusion, where do we go?
Yeah, so when it comes to solar panels, there are a couple of different tools that are available today that use satellite imagery to show you what the, kind of the sun exposure of your roof looks like. So if you're talking about putting solar panels on your roof, the first thing that I recommend to people is to go look for a solar map in your area so that you can see whether it's even reasonable to put solar panels on your roof. And if so, maybe only half the roof has that access, so you don't actually need to pay to cover your entire roof in those panels. Or maybe a spot on a garage or a backyard shed or something would be a better option for you, but you're not going to know until you look up that information first.
Oh, that's a really great tip because those guys that come knocking on your door, they're just gonna be like, yeah, you can put them up. You can finance it. It's gonna
Oh,
be
yeah.
great. They're gonna cost you nothing. I hate that. Oh, it's not gonna cost you anything. I'm like, sir, I do not think that's true.
There are a couple of different very free websites that you can go to that use solar maps, that use satellite photography to show you what the sun, looks like as it hits your roof during different parts of the day. And that information really helps inform what kind of stuff you want to put on your roof to even start that process.
In other tech news, Google just launched a new version of its Fitbit watch, one that may be ideal for kids. So it's called the Fitbit Ace LTE. So what makes it such a good fit for children?
So Fitbit has been making, these kind of step counter fitness products for kids for a little while now. And when Google acquired them, it was kind of a new ground for Google as a company because it had not made watches for children before. And that introduces a lot of new ground for a company that has never done that before, making sure that, you know, kids' data is protected and making sure that kids don't have access to things that they're not supposed to have access to. Like, those are really important things to check off. Fitbit had done a lot of that work already, but they had not yet released a watch that had a mobile network attached to it. And that means that you can do things like location tracking when they're not on a Wi-Fi network. And it means that you can have some of that two-way communication with a child that wasn't, you know, possible with some of the you know, kind of only Wi-Fi versions of those watches. So a lot of this work is pretty positive. You know, the screen on the watch looks nice. It fits really well for not just for kids that are going to school every day, but it's also a waterproof watch. So if a kid jumps in a pool or something like that, you're not out $200 for a watch. It's a pretty well thought out product if you have a child that can be taught to put things on a charger every night in the same way that mom and dad might with their watches, because it is a watch that connects to a mobile network, which means the battery is only going to last you about 2 days. And that watch does not do a whole lot of good if your child just takes it off and throws it on the bedside table every night and doesn't bother to charge it.
Will it work with most cell phone carriers? Is it pretty easy to buy one and then attach it to the cell phone plan, or do you have to get something separate?
So you are going to want a separate cellular plan. They end up being about $5 a month from Verizon and AT&T. I forget off the top of my head what T-Mobile's is, but I think it's also $5. You're gonna pay that monthly if you want them to have access to things like making phone calls with you, or, you know, being able to kind of track them in different
all
places.
All the features you would want.
That's right. And it's also not a mandatory thing to have on the watch. If you would prefer to only connect to an LTE network when your child is away at summer camp, or, you know, kind of visiting grandparents for a month or something like that, you don't have to permanently pay for those features. You can add and remove this watch from a plan as it applies to you.
How does it compare to, say, Verizon's Gizmo and some of the other smartwatches targeted at children?
So Gizmo's watch is interesting, but it is targeted at a much younger segment of kids. This is the Gizmo watches are video chat watches where the adult in that situation can initiate that call and, you know, kind of be like, hey, check in with me, tell me what you're doing. This is very much like a middle school / early high school age range for this watch, whereas the Gizmo watches are really more elementary school focused.
Yeah, because these Ace LTE watches can download games, track health and fitness stats. So it does, it's not quite the functionality of an Apple Watch, but it's not a Gizmo then.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, the parental controls on this, you know, depending on your parenting style, can be a little tiny bit restrictive. Our reviewer found that adding friends of your kids so that they could make calls with one another was actually quite complicated in the app, and is probably something that what other parents would probably give up on. But it is something that is possible. It's just not quite as easy as it maybe should be in that situation.
Hopefully.
On the other hand, if you feel like you only want your kid to talk to you through that watch, then that's not so bad.
Okay, so I was kind of wondering about that, because like Gizmo gives you, I think it's like a handful of numbers, like 5 numbers that they can call. Is that the same, where there's like a handful of numbers that are easy, but beyond that it gets complicated, or is it?
That's right. So the Fitbit app gives you these preferred contacts that you can put in, and there's a verification process that goes into that. And then once you've got those numbers, that's pretty well locked in place. You can add numbers. It's just really not easy.
While we're on the topic of fitness, and I find it strange that like children would be tracking their step counts, but I'm sure as you get into middle and high school, that comes about naturally. There's also Tonal, which is a at-home gym product. And so what major reviewers at CNET think that Tonal is a better equipment than, say, some of the other at-home products that are being offered?
Yeah. So, you know, when COVID lockdowns put everyone in their houses, there was a pretty big focus on how we could get as much of our kind of gym workout in the house as possible. And that started this rise of what was called fitness mirrors. where these things that you hung on the wall, and it had a, you know, camera and a TV built in, and it gave you these workouts that you could do. And what was really curious about that kind of burst of time is that all of the other companies that make these kind of fitness mirrors, that they've almost entirely stopped making those products. When people were able to kind of go outside and go to the gym, they kind of stopped with you know, being able to do those mirror things that weren't, except for Tonal. And a big part of that reason is that Tonal extended quite a bit beyond the mark on the wall. There was a bench and these great big arms that came out so that you could do just a wider range of workouts using what is called electric resistance. So there's a set of magnets that applied resistance instead of like weights that you would, you know, kind of adjust. And that made it a lot more convenient and a lot more kind of widespread. This is still not inexpensive. It is a $3,000 gym that you are strapping to the side of your house, so that you can, you know, kind of work out wherever you are. But if you need that home gym, this really ends up being the best all-around option right now.
That was Russell Holly, managing editor for CNET. Thank you, as always, for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.